This is a special tax update for July the 29th, 2008. Today, Home Run selected tax provisions from the housing bill. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in implementing tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do your own research and confirm amounts raised in the presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or documents part of the continuing education presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offer email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, over the weekend, the Congress managed to finalize work on the new housing bill, the full name, the American Housing Rescue and Foreclosure Prevention Act of 2008, and have sent the act on to the president for signature. Expectations are the president will sign the bill. Now, the bill has a number of provisions that are supposed to affect housing and the various items going on in the financial and mortgage markets. But the key issues we want to take a look at today are provisions that are tax-related. There are a number of tax-related provisions in this bill that are going to be of some interest to us. And we're going to concentrate today really on two key ones, briefly discuss a third. We're not going to deal with some of the other issues that may be of interest to some of you, and be aware some of the things that are in here include some areas like changes in the low-income housing credit, effects for tax-exempt housing bonds, mortgage revenue bonds, and real estate investment trust liberalization. We're not going to look in detail at those areas. What we are going to look at in a little more detail are changes that took effect for the credit for first-time home buyers, and a change that may initially be overlooked by many people, but a change in the use of Section 121's exclusion for gains on sale for property you dispose of, a limitation that will affect a technique that became somewhat popular, popular to discuss. I didn't have a whole lot of people use it, where you would try to shield your gain from vacation properties, rental properties, some other properties you had, by converting them to a principal residence for 2 years before you sold them. Congress is going to begin to limit the ability to do that one or to actually make use of that provision. Now, like most tax bills, this particular bill has some taxpayer-friendly provisions in it. And, of course, to pay for the taxpayer-friendly provisions, we have some not-so-taxpayer-friendly provisions in the bill. Those are the revenue raisers. Now, one we're not going to spend a lot of time discussing, but you need to be aware of, is that Congress enacted a provision that, beginning in 2011, that gross payments for credit cards and other payment methods such as PayPal paid to a business will have to be reported by the payor, the credit card paying company, or the vendor like PayPal. That's going to be an information reporting requirement. Now, again, it comes up in 2011, but that is in this bill, so be aware it's out there. Let's start, though, with the good news, because that's what Congress starts with in the bill. They understand, like everyone else, this is what they'd like to get the headlines, and this is what they'd like to have some concentration on, because they want credit for, quote, doing good. And, you know, doing good always seems like giving a break. And one of the key provisions from a tax standpoint that's in this bill is the new first-time homeowners credit. This new credit will become Section 36 of the Internal Revenue Code. Current Section 36 will just get bumped back to Section 37. Otherwise, everything else stays the same. So what we have is a new Section 36 credit. Now, this is important because the credits in that area of the code are refundable credits. So this particular credit can be refunded to the taxpayer even if the taxpayer doesn't owe sufficient tax to utilize the entire credit. That may be important due to the phase-out levels imposed on this credit. It may mean that some people who would qualify for this credit might not otherwise have enough tax liability facing them in order to make use of the credit. This particular provision is meant to encourage the purchase of homes by people who currently do not own homes. That was Congress's purpose. But as we've discovered before, when Congress uses the term first-time homebuyer, don't necessarily believe that that term means what you think it should mean by the term, And we'll discover that Congress again redefined the term, unfortunately, almost but not quite the way they redefined it the last time they visited the term. Now, the new law provides generally for a refundable credit available to first-time homebuyers. That credit is found in Section 2612 of the Act and adds, as I said, Section 36. Section 36 allows a credit equal to 10% of the purchase price of a residence to a first-time home buyer. That's in Section 36A. That credit is capped at $7,500, except for a married person filing a separate return, in which case then it's capped at $3,750. Interestingly enough, Section 36B1C deals explicitly with a case where you have two individuals who are not married to each other, but who jointly own the property or purchase the property. In that case, that provision, Section 36B1 cap C, provides that the amount of the credit allowed shall be allocated among the individuals in such a manner as the secretary may prescribe, except the total amount of credits to all individuals shall not exceed $7,500. That means we're going to be awaiting some guidance here from the IRS about the methods that are acceptable to divide the $7,500 credit between two unrelated taxpayers who happen to own the residence together. Those of us thinking informally remember the term living in sin, quote unquote, was the old-time term we like to use for such things or other alternate living arrangements that involve this multiple ownership. But there are many cases, no matter what the case is, Congress allows a splitting of this credit among those individuals who are not a married couple. Now notice it also said two or more, so we could have four or five people come together and purchase a house. And if they all use it as a principal residence, we could divide the $7,500 credit up among all those five individuals. That also is allowed under the bill. Now, like all breaks Congress has enacted in recent years, you know there's going to be a phase out, and we're not disappointed. Section 36B2 provides that in general we're going to phase it out based on a modified adjusted gross income in excess of $75,000 or $150,000 in the case of a joint return. So again, facing this issue, we now find that we have the $75,000-$150,000 limitation. So we're looking at the amount that we'll be able to take the credit. It's going to be limited by those individuals who have to have an income, if they are filing single, below $75,000, if they are filing a married couple filing a joint return, below $100,000. As well, the credit's going to max out of purchase price of a new home of $75,000. Once we get above $75,000, which is well below the median price of a home, we're going to end up with having the credit capped at $7,500. At this point in time, even with the decrease in housing prices that we have seen following the crash, it doesn't appear that, you know, for a lot of people, this will just basically be a $7,500 credit, period, not necessarily 10%. If you do have a case where the purchase price is less than $75,000, and remember, you can't expand this through joint ownership, so we have to have $7,500 is going to be our cap, then what we will be facing is a $7,500 is our limit, not easily expandable. Now, the other provision that could get interesting about that two or more person situation becomes, at what point do we have two or more living quarters, and will we see a living quarters rule much as we saw for the rules involving the home office rule under Section 121? That is, if three of us get together and buy a triplex, are we going to be able to count that as three residences or one? If I buy a condominium in a high-rise condominium project, obviously we don't have to divide that up among everybody in the building. But the question is going to become, at what point, what will define for our purposes what are multiple residences? We don't know until we see regulations under this, but it would seem to make some sense to me that we may very well find that that living quarter guidance we find in Section 121, the separate living quarter rule, is going to come into play again here in a very similar situation, that we're going to find we need to have the separate living quarters to consider that property to be three residences rather than one residence with three owners. Now, definitions, as always, are key to understanding the statute. And let's go on to Section 36C, where we actually get the definitions for this provision. First thing is, who's a first-time home buyer? Well, as before, that doesn't mean somebody who has never owned a principal residence, nor does it even mean somebody, nor did it before, who doesn't currently own a residence. They just can't own a principal one. The new Section 36C1 provides that the first-time homebuyer means an individual, if such individual, and if married, that individual's spouse, had no present ownership interest in a principal residence during a 3-year period ending on the date of purchase of the principal residence to which this section applies. If you remember in our exception under Section 72 for the exception from the 10% extra tax imposed on distributions from an individual retirement account, that we could escape that by withdrawing up to $10,000 for a first-time home buyer, there the definition was 2 years, not 3. We have what is essentially the same definition here except for the time period, which becomes 3 years. So under these provisions, someone could be a first-time home buyer and qualify for the waiver of the 10% penalty on the first $10,000 taken out of the IRA, but fail to qualify for the credit of $7,500 on the purchase of that residence. Other thing to remember too here is that this time it's clear that the married individual is going to be deemed to be tainted by the spouse. That will be true even if that married individual is filing a separate return or not filing a joint return with the spouse. Nothing gets us out of this test by simply filing a separate return for the year in which we have this, where we want to make this purchase of a residence to get the $7,500 refundable credit. Now, going on to the next definition, the good news is for definition of principal residence, Congress did just simply borrow the definition from Section 121. Section 36C2 provides the term principal residence has the same meaning as when used in Section 121. In Section C3, we find out what a purchase is, and Section C3A says, in general, the term purchase means any acquisition. So our default test is that any way we acquire a residence will be deemed to be a purchase, and then we start throwing out the exceptions. First exception, the property cannot be acquired from a person related to the person acquiring it. So we cannot acquire the property from a related party. As we'll discuss later in the definitions, we do have a specific rule as to who is a related party, and there is one interesting exception as who is not a related party in this case. And the basis of the property in the hand of the person acquiring it is not determined in whole or in part by reference to the adjusted basis of the hands of the person from whom it was first acquired. That's another exception that won't qualify. What case would you reference the basis from the person you acquired it from? Think gift. If the property is gifted to you, you take over the basis, or you take over a basis that's by reference to the basis of the person that gave you the piece of property, was a gift acquisition. As such, that basis would be considered, that property is not going to qualify for the $7,500 credit. Second issue, or it's under Section 1014A if the basis is determined there. Section 1014 deals with the basis of inherited property, property that gets a step up on the death of a decedent that passes through the estate. If you inherit the residence, that will also not qualify. So essentially, this provision is looking at blocking inheritances, and blocking people from just selling the property to the kids and getting the kids a credit based upon that sale of the residence to the kids. That makes some sense. Those three items are probably not what Congress was aiming for when Congress was thinking about doing this provision. The point of this was not necessarily to create a tax break. The point of this is to get people out there buying homes that otherwise would set unsold. Now, an interesting second definition that at first may seem puzzling until we get to the effective dates on this is what's construction. And under Section C3B of Section 36, we're told a residence which is constructed by the taxpayer shall be treated as purchased by the taxpayer on the date the taxpayer first occupies such residence. Now, given the effective date, that has a couple of interesting attributes. First, If a person had already entered into a contract prior to the effective date of this provision, as we'll discover, that effective date is April 1st of 2008, but they didn't occupy the residence, they didn't basically finish construction and occupy the residence till after April 1st of this year, they could still qualify for the first-time home owner's credit. Secondly, this credit expires July 1st of next year. That means if you enter into a contract to purchase a residence in 2009, the early part of 2009, but for whatever reason that property is not completed and you do not occupy it by July 1st, you lose out on the $7,500 credit, at least if Congress does not extend this law. That may create a real issue for some construction contractors and home builders as we start approaching, especially those that cater to the entry-level home buyer market, as we begin to run into that July 1st deadline next year. Now, honestly, given the collapse of the real estate and home sales market, that type of problem is probably the least of the worries of those contractors today and those home builders today. They would love to have that problem of having too much work and having to rush to get it done by a deadline. But nevertheless, your client should be aware that they want to take advantage of this provision and they want to have their house constructed rather than buy an existing house. They need to not just sign the contract by next July, they need to occupy the residence by next July. Purchase price is defined as Section 36C4, and that just merely references the adjusted basis of the principal residence on the date the residence is purchased, realizing purchase means we acquired it by whatever means. Related persons are defined at C5. That provision says that the related person, if the relationship between such persons would result in disallowance of losses under Section 267 or the 707B disallowance provisions related to partnership. Now, that's not surprising because those two sections are often used to determine related parties for tax purposes, but a special exception is built in here. We're told in applying to Section 267B and C for the purpose of this section, Paragraph 4 of Section 267C shall be treated as providing that the family of individuals shall include only his spouse, ancestors, and lineal descendants. Now, if you go back and check 267C4, you'll find out what that just did. 267C4 starts out by including brothers, sisters, the siblings, then includes the spouse, the ancestors, and the lineal descendants. What that means is purchasing a residence from your brother or your sister will not be considered to be purchasing the property from a related party that would create the disallowance of the credit under Section 36. You can buy from the sibling. What you cannot do is buy from mom and dad, nor can you buy from the children or the grandchildren. We should expect that Congress will, or that the IRS will work out some deal, work out regulations, or work out other issues that will deal with people who try to get creative and sell first to one kid that already owns a home, and then have that kid just out of the blue decide to turn around and sell to child two, such arranged sales. I'm sure someone's going to think of trying it. I'm also fairly certain that the IRS will take a dim view of such constructs and wouldn't be surprised to see such constructs specifically attacked by the IRS in the guidance they give initially on this provision. Now, Section 36D provides four exceptions to the credit. That is, these are four cases where even if you cleared all the hurdles, you won't otherwise be able to claim the credit. First, if you're claiming a credit for the first-time home buyer in the District of Columbia under 1400 Cap C, we should say. That makes sense. Obviously, you're not going to be able to double dip and get that credit plus this credit. Second, if the residence is financed by proceeds of a qualified mortgage issue, the interest of which is exempt from tax under Section 103. Section 103 deals generally with municipal, state, and local bonds. So if you have a qualified mortgage issue that's used to finance, to provide mortgage financing for people in the community that's financed by state and local tax-exempt bonds, the purchasers of those properties will not qualify for first-time home buyer. The theory there, I'm sure Congress has, is that we've already provided these people with a break, or we provided incentives. This is program A we've got to encourage these purchases. We're not going to let them take advantage of both this program and the credit. They get to choose one or the other. Third, if the taxpayer is a non-resident alien. Makes some sense, being a principal resident, that would mean the residence is outside the country. The person's a non-resident alien, so they're an alien, not a U.S. citizen, and they're living outside the U.S., they're not going to get this. The point of this was to increase U.S. home purchases. Now, interestingly of that, though, Congress chose not to state that you didn't get the credit if you purchased a property outside the United States. Rather, they limited it to non-resident aliens. If you are a U.S. citizen, not an alien, apparently the fact that the residence is being built in Nogales, Mexico, as opposed to Nogales, Arizona, wouldn't have an impact. You'll still get the credit. Or four, if the taxpayer disposes of the residence or such residence ceases to be the principal residence of the taxpayer and have married the taxpayer's spouse before the close of such taxable year. As we'll discover later, there are recapture provisions on this credit anyway. What this says is, though, is if you purchase the property and then before the end of the year it ceases to be your principal residence, or you dispose of it, you get rid of it before the end of the year, you're not getting the $7,500 credit. Now, the information reporting exception for sales of homes allowed under Section 6045E5 is addressed next, being potentially pulled for homes where the credit may be involved. That is, the transaction for the sale of the property now, because that could impact the fact that a sale of a residence took place. To the extent the IRS determines they need that information to enforce this provision of the law, we're not going to be able to get out of it as we could previously for sales that appeared to be exempt under Section 121 if we met the exceptions under 6045E. This credit is a little unusual because unlike most credits, you don't get to keep this one. You're going to pay it back, or you're probably going to pay it back. The general rule here is found in Section F1. Except as otherwise provided in this section, if that credit is allowed to the taxpayer, that is the up to $7,500 credit, the tax imposed by this chapter shall be increased by 6 2/3% of the amount of such credit for each taxable year in the recapture period. Well, 6 2/3% is 1/15, which means it's not surprising, as we discover at F7, that the recapture period means a 15-year taxable period beginning with the second taxable year following the taxable year in which the purchase credit was allowed. So what that means is after we take the credit in 1 year, we get 1 year to wait. Then the following year, we begin repaying that credit without interest over 15 years. So we get a $7,500 interest-free loan from the government is what happens. So if the credit is taken for 2008, then the recapture period would begin in 2010, because again, this is the second taxable year following taxable year for which the credit is allowed. At beginning in 2010, the recapture will continue for 15 years, at which time we would have repaid the total credit if it was a maximum $7,500 and be done. Well, hey, that sounds good. I get 15 years regardless. Well, no, not quite regardless. You need to hold the home for all 15 years if you want to stretch it out for 15, or you probably need to hold it for 15. There's an acceleration provision in Section 36F2, and that provides if you dispose of the residence or such residence ceases to be the principal residence of the taxpayer and have married the taxpayer's spouse before the end of the recapture period, the tax imposed by this chapter for the taxable year of such disposition or cessation shall be increased by the excess allowed over the tax imposed for the preceding year, and paragraph 1 shall not apply to any credit for such taxable year or such subsequent tax year. Okay, translated to English. Any amount you haven't already repaid, you have to repay when you sell or stop using that as your principal residence. Now, there are limitations and exceptions on the recapture. First one, if we have a disposition event, the recapture to be repaid is capped at the amount of gain we realize. Now, it's an adjusted gain, but it's still the gain we realize. We compute our gain on disposing of that property. Now, that's before we worry about whether or not Section 121 would exclude it. However, in computing the gain for this repayment purposes, we have to reduce the basis of the property by any unpaid amount remaining on the credit. So if we had gone halfway through and we had $3,750 of credit yet unrecaptured, we would have to take our original purchase price of the property, reduce that by $3,750, and then use that to compute a gain or loss. Similarly, there are additional exceptions to the recapture rule altogether. The first one's not surprising. It's the event that solves most tax problems. If the taxpayer just agrees to die, they don't have to repay the amount. That is, the paragraphs 1 and 2 shall not apply to any taxable year, it says. This is under Section 36F4 Cap A, any taxable year ending after the date of the taxpayer's death. So that means you also won't have recapture in the year of death. Now, as we'll note later, if a joint return was filed in the year in which the credit was claimed, one half of the credit shall be deemed to be allocable to each spouse. So if one spouse dies, half of the issue goes away. The other half remains. Now remember, if the individuals were not married, we had the split, and we'd go back to the initial split to determine how much we get rid of at the death of one or the other individuals. Involuntary conversions also don't trigger repayments. This is under F4B. What happens in an involuntary conversion is, under Section 1033, the home burns down and we get replacement property. Under 1033, as long as we acquire a new principal residence during the two-year period beginning on the date of disposition or cessation, then we continue to qualify, but our taint carries over to the new property. So that means if the new property ceases to be our principal residence, we dispose of it. Then we are stuck with having to go ahead and compute the recapture at that point. Under F4C, we have transfers between spouses or incident to a divorce. As you might guess, that could be an issue. We were married. Half of this went to each of us. We get divorced. Now one of us ends up with the property. Does that trigger an immediate recapture for the one that became the out spouse? And does that mean that the other spouse now faces only having to repay half of it? No, it doesn't work that way. Rather, it follows the standard rules that we saw in 1014, the concept there being that attributes follow whoever gets the property. In this case, the taint, the liability to repay, will follow the property to the spouse that gets it. So if we have a transfer incident to a divorce or between spouses otherwise, whatever spouse ends up with the property ends up with the problem. Now, the joint return split is found in 36F5. So if you have a joint return, 36F5 tells us that we are deemed to have half of the credit incurred and picked up by each spouse. As notice, if we have a death or other activity, or one of the spouses ceases to use it as their principal residence, I should say. Actually, that last point's not clear. It appears that as long as we have at least one spouse in it, we're fine. But if we have a divorce situation or we have a death, we have a potential issue where each spouse is liable. Let's say we have a divorce and we get rid of the property. Often happens in a divorce. We're filing separate returns for that year now, or we basically became filing single that year. So the divorce was finalized in the same year. So we filed joint the year before, we signed up, filed single this year, and the property is disposed of this year. Each spouse is liable for one half of the debt. Now that's also an interesting concept because it can create problems if one spouse gets the property and then shortly thereafter discovers that he or she cannot afford to keep it. That's been known to happen in divorces where people didn't think through all the consequences or didn't figure out how we were going to handle this particular mortgage. Sometimes that's a problem because we discover that the mortgage needs to be rewritten, but no one will refinance the new spouse. In a worst-case scenario, a spouse that got stuck in that position could find him or herself stuck with the repayment of the whole amount due to the transfers incident to divorce provision meaning that the property went to you, but we discovered that we had a mistake of fact and there was no way we could get refinanced. And now we have to get out because we have a commitment to get the other spouse off the mortgage, and the only way to do that is sell the property. Now we have a problem. And now we could potentially have an expensive tax issue coming down the line, or at least maybe not, it depends on how expensive you think things are. But I know more than a few people that wouldn't be thrilled to suddenly have to come up with $7,500 rather than $3,750. F6 tells us that we have a return requirement. What that means is if we weren't otherwise required to file a tax return per section 6012, we still have to file one if we're in the 15-year recapture period and a liability would occur under this provision. So you don't get out of this by merely otherwising ending up with no taxable income. You're going to have to file and repay this tax. Now, the provision's effective date is found in Section 36H, and it's important. It applies only to a principal residence purchased by the taxpayer on or after April 9, 2008. Remember the construction rule. If it was constructed residence, the date they occupied it, if it was after April 9th, and no, nobody ever told us that was the key date that we had to be in after. But if they occupied after April 9th, that'll be a purchase on or after that date. If they moved in on April 8th, well, tough luck. And before July 1st, 2009. Now, it's a short window, but that also means for those constructed residences, you're going to have to be very careful that the property is actually completed and you're able to take ownership and move in on or before July 1st of 2009, meaning there'll be a lot of people rushing around the end of June next year, potentially trying to get into the residence to qualify for this. Finally, 36G gives us a special rule that can apply to those taxpayers who don't get in the residence by the end of this year or don't purchase by the end of 2008, but purchase in the first part of 2009. Under the special provision found at 36G, those taxpayers can elect to treat the purchase date as if it was December 31st, 2008, for all purposes except the purpose of determining whether they weren't an owner for 3 years before the date of purchase. Now, that last part, as we noted, is somewhat important because it's very possible you might fail on December 31st, but you could pass by sometime in 2009. If so, as long as you have your purchase by after that date in 2009 and before July 1st, you could still go back and reduce your tax for 2008. Now, since the deemed purchase is 2008, your repayment year is going to start in 2010. Now, this particular provision, to be honest, after looking at it, I've decided that the vast majority of my clients will not benefit from it. But I do suspect an awful lot of them are going to read about the provision in the paper. Those few who actually bought something this year may believe they're qualified for the credit when, in fact, they don't have a chance. Others may try to do things like saying, oh, I could sell this rental property to my kid. My kid will get the credit. We have to understand the rules here to understand what does and doesn't work, and understand that if we do have a case where someone could qualify, the fact that we're under some tight time constraints coming up here to make sure things get done and things happen in a timely manner. So it's one of these credits that probably, to be honest, I'll be surprised if I see more than a handful of returns that have it on it, or if I even see any. But I also know that I'm probably going to have to talk about it a number of times. And I'll talk about it far more times with a lot of people that it couldn't possibly apply to, and my main problem is going to be explaining why it doesn't work for them. Now, we also have a non-itemizer's real estate deduction. This one's an interesting thing because what Congress did here was actually not give us what we've often been given when we've been given something and say, oh, non-itemizers can take something like the teachers with the teaching expenses. Well, we got that as an adjustment to adjusted gross income. Rather, in this case, we increase the standard deduction by the amount of the property taxes, but not to exceed $500 for an individual, or I should say $350, or $700 for a joint return. Now, the point of that is there's twofold as to why Congress would do it that way. Remember, property taxes are one of those items we don't get to deduct for alternative minimum tax purposes. Now, the teacher's deduction, when we moved that money up above the line, that meant even if the AMT applied, the teacher still effectively got the deduction for what was otherwise an employee business expense that quite often disappeared at the 2% limitation, and if it cleared it, AMT clobbered it. In this case, Congress decided not to give us the out where if we were a non-itemizer, we could move it up above the line. I suspect that was because otherwise some people subject to the AMT would quickly, elect the standard deduction and go ahead in some cases take the standard, or not the standard, would elect to use the standard deduction, not itemize. It may not change their AMT at all, or very minorly, depends upon their other itemized deductions. But it could very well have allowed a deduction for real estate taxes. That is, the main things we get to deduct for AMT purposes are charitable contributions we get to deduct. We get to deduct medical, but only in excess of 10%. That's not great. And home mortgage interest. Somebody didn't have a lot of home mortgage interest, but was in a relatively high tax state. That person might find they're subject to AMT, but they might find if they turned that around, they could take the real estate taxes above the line up to $350 or a married couple $700. By making it the standard deduction is not deductible for AMT purposes. Therefore, there's no impact. It's not going to get you out. It's not going to create an AMT benefit by being able to make use of this. What it does mean is, though, is that your software now will check and the standard deduction will essentially become, for purposes of testing against itemizing, the standard deduction we usually have plus real estate taxes, or if less, $350 for non-married filing joint, $700 for married filing joint. So that is our adjustment for that year. That particular change only is going to apply, is going to be a limited 2008 benefit only. So it's a one-year only benefit. It disappears from the law after that. That is one of those provisions, though, that may not stay out of the law. That's the sort of thing that seems ripe to become part of an annual technical correction. Now, an issue we won't consider in detail, because once you finish up, you decide this doesn't apply to most of my clients, but it could apply. If it applies, it'll be significant. And if you work with larger clients, larger corporate clients that have big AMT credit carryovers that they've been building for a while and are now in a loss position, this could be significant. Per Section 3081 of the Act, a taxpayer will be able to elect, in lieu of claiming accelerated depreciation on the property, remember our bonus depreciation that we got special for this year, a taxpayer can instead take a special credit equal, can use up old AMT and research and development credits that are equal to 20% of the difference between the depreciation under accelerated methods and the depreciation under the election. So our extra bonus, we give up the bonus, we can get a credit equal to the 20% of that differential, and we can claim that credit as a refundable credit. That's mainly going to be a benefit to entities that are in loss positions. As CCH mentioned, their analysis of this act, in the last act we got for the economic stimulus package, unlike what we got back in 2001, we didn't get any special provision enhancing net operating loss carrybacks. This is a backdoor kind of offering up in a small way to make up for the fact that we didn't fix the NOL carryback rule. However, we have to have old AMT credits in a C corporation. The caps on this are there, but they're interestingly high. The amount is capped at $30 million or 6% of the credits accumulated from 2005 or earlier years. So what that means is I've got to have very significant prior to 2005 credits for this to be worth an awful lot. What we're doing is we still get the full depreciation eventually, we're just changing the timing. However, changing that timing may not be worth a whole lot if we're talking about $6 of credit and we're hoping to some point get profitable again. We would presume we think we're going to be able to pull off some point, in which case then our future taxes would go up. If we think, though, it's going to be over 5 years, let's say, before we get back to profitability, then maybe waiving those waiving the accelerated isn't such a big deal. But again, 6% of the prior to 2005 credits and $30 million cap, this appears aimed at large entities. Now let's go ahead to the bad news provisions. We talked about the credit card one already, credit card and PayPal reporting, beginning in 2011. There will be a de minimis exception there for proceeds paid that are less than $20,000 per year. But any entity receiving more than $20,000 per year will be required to be reported upon by the payor. As well, these provisions will subject the payor will subject the payments to the backup withholding provisions, meaning if an ID number is not provided, the backup withholding will come off of there. And Congress again bounced corporate estimated taxes. If you deal with large corporations, you know that we had a really crazy set of percentages for what happened with the estimates in 2012. Well, now you can forget about all those 2012 changes. We went all back to the standard for 2012. And now 2013 is the year in which we make changes. And I'd go over the percentages, but Congress loves to change these on the fly anyway. So anyone who seriously believes that the different percentages we now have for 2013 are going to stand there all the way through 2013, well, I got this bridge in Brooklyn that I want to talk to you about. Rather, we can expect that Congress will continue to use this as basically a gimmick to move some funds around between different fiscal years. Finally, let's talk about the big one, though, that I think is an issue that some of our clients will have to worry about. This is a reduced home sale exclusion that will become available effective the beginning of next year. What Congress is doing is to reduce the availability of the following technique. I have a vacation home in Flagstaff, and my regular home is in Phoenix. I retire, I sell my regular home. The home in Flag I have had for ages. It is highly appreciated. If I sold it right now, I would pay significant capital gains. However, if my wife and I move up there and make that our principal residence for 2 years, we can then sell the residence in Flagstaff and exclude up to $500,000 of gain. And even if our gain's greater than that, still capital gains tax on $500,000, not paying that, nothing to sneeze at, especially heading into a 20% capital gains rate and the fact that the state of Arizona and most states will recognize the 121 exclusion. So that gets rid of another up to 5% under Arizona law, somewhat less than 5%. I could be keeping some significant money. I'm not too disappointed, shall we say, in that strategy. Congress has said, wait a minute, we're not going to let that one happen. We're going to change how that works now. You still will be able to use 121 in that case, just not the whole thing. The general provision is found in new section 121B4. It provides that the exclusion under 121 shall not apply to so much of the gains from the sale or exchange of property as is allocated to periods of non-qualified use. Non-qualified use will be the key provision here. What is our period of non-qualified use? The ratio is defined in section 121B4B. We're going to ratio based on time. That tells us for a purpose of determining how much of our gain is from non-qualified use, we do not go out and get an appraisal and set the value at the date we start using it as a residence. We don't set the values at the date we convert it from residential use. Rather, although we might need to do that for other reasons, you know, depreciation, etc., we have the lower of basis or fair value at date of conversion. Please don't forget that. But presuming that's not our issue, for this purpose, we don't. This is simply a time period allocation. I take the periods of non-qualified use during the period which I own the property, and I take that over the total period. So if I owned the property for 10 years, 6 of those years were non-qualified use, 60% of my gain is not eligible for Section 121 exclusion, and only 40% can be excluded under Section 121. Now the non-qualifying period rule is found in Section 121B4C i. It provides that period of non-qualified use means any period, important exception here parenthetically that's going to be very useful for your clients right now, other than the portion of any period preceding January 1st, 2009. during which the property is not used as a principal residence of the taxpayer or the taxpayer's spouse or former spouse. That's an interesting provision, because what it says is, as of this instant right now, nobody has any period of non-qualifying use. Every day through January 1st, 2009, all the way through the end of this year, will be deemed to be qualifying use of the property, even if we have never used the property as a residence. However, the clock starts running on non-qualifying use periods January 1st of next year. At that point, if we are not using the property as our principal residence, that's a non-qualifying period, and it will be deemed to be pro rata. Part of the appreciation will occur during that non-qualifying period. Now, that pro rata allocation may or may not be useful to the client. At this point in time, since in many places values have been dropping, if a client moved into a property today, that may not be, it may be that in fact there's no appreciation. The appreciation may all occur after they started using it as their principal residence. Won't matter. Reality is that this is going to be a straight allocation. If I had owned the property for 5 years before January 1st, if I'd owned the property for 5 years, let's get out past January 1st, 2009, and let's start in the future where this would actually count. If I owned the property for 5 years, January 1st, 2009, I buy it, and through January 1st, 2014, and then January 1st, 2014, I finally move into it. January 1st, 2019, I sell the property. Half the property period I used it, half the period is non-qualifying, half qualifying. The real estate market in the area stayed in the doldrums all the way from the beginning of 2009 through January 1st, 2014. And then we had another period of skyrocketing real estate values from 2014 to 2019. So I paid $500,000 for the property. The property at January 1st, 2014 was still worth $500,000. I moved into it, used it as my principal residence. January 1st, 2019, I sell it for $1,000,000. Half the gain cannot be excluded under Section 121. If I'm married, which I am, and we use the married couple exclusion, we're still limited to 250. Not the 500, because half our gain is ineligible. Now, there are some exceptions. The first one deals with a very real case we see today. What happens if I've sold, I purchased my new residence, I moved into it, but I'm still trying to sell the old one? Obviously, I'm not using my new residence. I'm no longer using the old one as my principal residence. Am I building a non-qualifying period? Answer, no, as long as I go ahead and complete this sale. It tells us that the portion of the five-year period, which is after the last date it is used as principal residence of the taxpayer, taxpayer spouse, is not a non-qualified use. What that means is I have to be within the five-year testing period under 121A. I look to 121A. I can go from the date of the sale, basically, back to the last time that I used it as a principal residence. Those dates from when I last used it as my principal residence through the date of sale will not be non-qualified use during that 121, as long as I meet the 121 testing period. So that means I can move out of the house and perhaps even rent it for 2 or 3 years, which is something a lot of people have been doing recently who can't get the price they need to get for the house. They're turning around and putting on the rental market, and then if they get a good offer, they'll go ahead and sell the property. That will still work under this provision. As well, there's the exception for military duty and foreign service duty. That up to a 10-year period will not be disqualified use under this provision. That's the same thing as we found under 121. And third, any period of temporary absence not to exceed an aggregate of 2 years due to a change in employment, health condition, or unforeseen circumstances as may be specified by the secretary. So if we have a period where we temporarily abandon the residence for a period of time, and it meets the exceptions that are provided, or we can convince the secretary it was an unforeseen circumstance, we can have that not count as a non-qualifying period. Finally, we coordinate this with the depreciation recapture provision, and generally what we find out is that we apply these rules after we apply the depreciation recapture rules for the sale of a home, and it shall be applied, and we will apply the ratio without regard to any of the gain to which the depreciation recapture rule applies. So basically, those rules are done first, then we go back and do this computation. Now, that particular provision is one that if you had clients who had read articles in places or had heard the theory about convert your vacation home, you buy this real estate, and what you'll do is you'll move into it, then, you know, when you finally get rid of your old house, when you finally get rid of your longtime family home, you'll move into this rental property, and you'll stay there for 2 years, and then you'll sell it off, which I always thought was a wonder in theory, but I never had a client that ever wanted to move into the rental property. But presuming you had one, you need to warn those clients that strategy won't work any longer. Neither will it work to use that to bootstrap a vacation home and make that into a property that's going to get a full benefit of Section 121, presuming your gain was under a $500,000 or $250,000 as applicable. Now, these new provisions are going to hit the press, and this is a very brief summary of these provisions based upon my initial scan of the law and some reading I've done on the from analysis from a couple of other sources about what these changes do. Be very careful. Be sure to check this back to the law itself. I've tried to check back to what I believe is the final version of the bill as passed, but we'll know a lot more about that in the next week. Also, a number of these provisions clearly have to have IRS interpretations about how to handle them, so keep your eyes there. But hopefully this part, getting this out early, will help you at least talk intelligently with your clients about those issues that maybe they need to have a heads up on based on this bill, and explain to the clients how that particular credit will or won't work in their situation. As always, this has been the Tax Update, and the Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Visit Limeburg Services and consider subscribing to their newsletters of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.